and the pills had worked wonders. When Cora finished her Saturday washing and had supper, it was almost time for the social. She put on her new blue dress. It was the prettiest one at the Colored Emporium. She shopped there as little as possible on account of the markup. From shopping for Mrs. Anderson, she was horrified that things in their local establishment cost 2 or 3 times as much as those in the white stores. As for the dress, it had cost a week's wages, and she was forced to use scrip. She had been careful about her spending for the most part. Money was new and unpredictable, and liked to go where it pleased. Some of the girls owed months of wages and resorted to scrip for everything now. Cora understood why, after the town deducted for food, housing, and miscellany like upkeep on the dormitories and school books, there was little left. Best to rely on scrip's credit sparingly. The dress was a one-time affair, Cora assured herself. The girls in the bunk room were in a state of great excitement over the evening's gathering. Cora was no exception. She finished primping. Perhaps Caesar was already on the green. He waited on one of the benches, affording a view of the gazebo and the musicians. He knew she was not going to dance. From across the green, Caesar seemed older than he had in his Georgia days. She recognized his evening clothes from the stacks in the Colored Emporium, but he wore them with more confidence than other men his age who hailed from plantations. The factory work agreed with him, as well as the other elements of their improved circumstances, of course. In the week since they last saw each other, he had cultivated a mustache. Then she saw the flowers. She complimented him on the bouquet and thanked him. He complimented her on her dress. He had tried to kiss her a month after they emerged from the tunnel. She pretended it didn't happen, and since then he had joined this performance. One day they would address it. Maybe at that time she would kiss him. She didn't know.
"I know them," Caesar said.
He pointed at the band as they took their places.
"I think they might even be better than George and Wesley."
Cora and Caesar grew more casual about referring to Randall in public as the months passed. Much of what they said could apply to any former slave who overheard them. A plantation was a plantation. One might think one's misfortunes distinct, but the true horror lay in their universality. In any event, the music would soon cover their talk of the Underground Railroad. Cora hoped the musicians wouldn't think them rude for their inattention. It was unlikely. Playing their music as free men and not chattel was probably still a cherished novelty. To attack the melody without the burden of providing one of the sole comforts of their slave village. To practice their art with liberty and joy. The Proctors arranged the socials to foster healthy relations between colored men and women, and to undo some of the damage to their personalities wrought by slavery. By their reckoning, the music and dancing, the food and punch, all unfolding on the green in the flickering lantern light, were a tonic for the battered soul. For Caesar and Cora, it was one of their few opportunities to catch each other up. Caesar worked in the machine factory outside town, and his changing schedule rarely overlapped with hers. He liked the work. Every week the factory assembled a different machine, determined by the volume of orders. The men arranged themselves before the conveyor belt, and each was responsible for attaching his assigned component to the shape moving down the line. At the start of the belt, there was nothing, a pile of waiting parts, and when the last man was finished, the result lay before them, whole. It was unexpectedly fulfilling, Caesar said, to witness the complete product in contrast to the disembodied toil on Randall. The work was monotonous but not taxing. The changing products helped with the tedium. The lengthy rest breaks were well distributed throughout the shift, arranged according to a labor theorist, often quoted by the foremen and managers. The other men were fine fellows. Some still bore the marks of plantation behavior, eager to redress perceived slights and acting as if they still lived under the yoke of reduced resources. But these men improved every week, fortified by the possibilities of their new lives. The former fugitives traded news. Maisie lost a tooth. This week, the factory manufactured locomotive engines. Caesar wondered whether they would one day be used by the Underground Railroad. The prices at the Emporium had gone up again, he observed. This was not news to Cora. How is Sam? Cora asked. It was easier for Caesar to meet with the station agent.
In his usual temper. Cheerful for no reason you can tell. One of the louts at the tavern gave him a black eye. He's proud of it. Says he'd always wanted one.
And the other? He crossed his hands on his thighs.
There's a train in a few days, if we want to take it.
He said that last part as if he knew her attitude. Perhaps the next one.
Yes, maybe the next one.
Three trains had passed through since the pair arrived. The first time they talked for hours over whether it was wiser to depart the dark South immediately or see what else South Carolina had to offer. By then they had gained a few pounds, earned wages, and begun to forget the daily sting of the plantation. But there had been real debate, with Cora agitating for the train and Caesar arguing for the local potential. Sam was no help. He was fond of his birthplace and an advocate of South Carolina's evolution on matters of race. He didn't know how the experiment would turn out, and he came from a long line of rabble-rousers, distrustful of the government, but Sam was hopeful. They stayed. Maybe the next one. The next one came and went with a shorter discussion. Cora had just finished a splendid meal in her dormitory. Caesar had bought a new shirt. The thought of starving again on the run was not attractive, nor was the prospect of leaving behind the things they had purchased with their toil. The third train came and went, and now this fourth one would too. Maybe we should stay for good, Cora said. Caesar was silent. It was a beautiful night. As he promised, the musicians were very talented and played the rags that had made everyone happy at previous socials. The fiddler came from this or that plantation, the banjo man from another state. Every day the musicians in the dormitories shared the melodies from their regions, and the body of music grew. The audience contributed dances from their own plantations and copied each other in the circles. The breeze cooled them when they broke away to rest and flirt. Then they started in again, laughing and clapping hands.
Maybe we should stay, Caesar repeated.
It was decided. The social ended at midnight. The musicians put out a hat for donations, but most people were deep in script by Saturday night, so it remained empty. Cora said goodnight to Caesar and was on her way home when she witnessed an incident. The woman ran through the green near the schoolhouse. She was in her 20s, of slender build, and her hair stuck up wildly. Her blouse was open to her navel, revealing her breasts. For an instant, Cora was back on Randall and about to be educated in another atrocity. Two men grabbed the woman and as gently as they could stopped her flailing. A crowd gathered. One girl went to fetch the proctors from over by the schoolhouse. Cora shouldered her way in. The woman blubbered incoherently and then said suddenly, "My babies! They're taking away my babies!" The onlookers sighed at the familiar refrain. They had heard it so many times in plantation life. the lament of the mother over her tormented offspring. Cora remembered Caesar's words about the men at the factory who were haunted by the plantation. Carrying it here despite the miles, it lived in them. It still lived in all of them, waiting to abuse and taunt when chance presented itself. The woman calmed down somewhat and was led back to the dormitory at the very rear of the line. Despite the comfort brought by their decision to stay, it was a long night for Cora as her thoughts returned to the woman's screams and the ghosts she called her own.
Will I be able to say goodbye? To the Andersons? And the children? Cora asked.
Miss Lucy was sure that could be arranged. The family was fond of her, she said.
Did I do a bad job?
Cora thought she had made a fine adjustment to the more delicate rhythms of domestic work. She ran her thumb across the pads of her fingers. They were so soft now.
You did a splendid job, Bessie, Miss Lucy said. That's why, when this new placement came up, we thought of you. It was my idea, and Miss Handler seconded it. The museum needs a special kind of girl, she said, and not many of the residents have adapted as well as you have. You should take it as a compliment.
Cora was reassured, but lingered in the doorway.
Anything else, Bessie?
Miss Lucy asked, squaring her papers. 2 days after the incident at the social, Cora was still troubled. She asked after the screaming woman. Miss Lucy nodded in sympathy.
You're referring to Gertrude, she said. I know it was upsetting. She's fine. They're keeping her in bed for a few days until she's herself again.
Miss Lucy explained that there was a nurse on hand checking on her. That's why we reserved that dormitory for residents with nervous disorders. It doesn't make sense for them to mix with the larger population. In number 40, they can get the care they require.
I didn't know 40 was special, Cora said. It's your hob.
I'm sorry, Miss Lucy asked, but Cora didn't elaborate.
They're only there for a short time, the white woman added. We're optimistic.
Cora didn't know what optimistic meant. She asked the other girls that night if they were familiar with the word. None of them had heard it before. She decided that it meant trying. The walk to the museum was the same route she took to the Andersons until she turned right at the courthouse. The prospect of leaving the family made her sorrowful. She had little contact with the father, as he left the house early and his office window was one of those in the Griffin that stayed lit the latest. Cotton had made him a slave, too. But Mrs. Anderson had been a patient employer, especially after her doctor's prescriptions, and the children were pleasant. Maisie was 10. By that age, on the Randall plantation, all the joy was ground out. One day a pickaninny was happy, and the next the light was gone from them. In between, they had been introduced to a new reality of bondage. Maisie was spoiled, doubtless, but there were worse things than being spoiled if you were colored. The little girl made Cora wonder what her own children might be like one day. She'd seen the Museum of Natural Wonders many times on her strolls, but never knew what the squat limestone building was for. It occupied an entire block. Statues of lions guarded the long, flat steps, seeming to gaze thirstily at the large fountain. Once Cora walked into its influence, the sound of the splashing water dampened the street noise, lifting her into the auspices of the museum. Inside, she was taken through a door that was off-limits to the public, and led into a maze of hallways. Through half-opened doors, Cora glimpsed curious activities. A man put a needle and thread to a dead badger. Another held up yellow stones to a bright light. In a room full of long wooden tables and apparatus, she saw her first microscopes. They squatted on the tables like black frogs. Then she was introduced to Mr. Field, the curator of living history.
"You'll do perfectly," he said, scrutinizing her as the men in the rooms had scrutinized the projects on their work tables. His speech at all times was quick and energetic, without a trace of the South. She later discovered that Mr. Fields had been hired from a museum in Boston to update the local practices.
"Been eating better since you came, I see," he said. "To be expected, but you'll do fine."
"I start cleaning in here first, Mr. Fields?"
Cora had decided on the way over that in her new position, she would avoid the cadences of plantation speech the best she could.
"Cleaning? Oh, no. You know what we do here."
He stopped.
"Have you been here before?"
He explained the business of museums. In this one, the focus was on American history. For a young nation, there was so much to educate the public about. The untamed flora and fauna of the North American continent, the minerals and other splendors of the world beneath their feet. Some people never left the counties where they were born, he said. Like a railroad, the museum permitted them to see the rest of the country beyond their small experience, from Florida to Maine to the western frontier, and to see its people.
"People like you," Mr. Field said.
Cora worked in three rooms. That first day, gray drapes covered the large glass windows that separated them from the public. The next morning, the drapes were gone, and the crowds arrived. The first room was Scenes from Darkest Africa. A hut dominated the exhibit, its walls wooden poles lashed together under a peaked thatch roof. Cora retreated into its shadows when she needed a break from the faces. There was a cooking fire, the flames represented by shards of red glass, a small, roughly made bench, and assorted tools, gourds, and shells. Three large black birds hung from the ceiling on a wire. The intended effect was that of a flock circling over the activity of the natives. They reminded Cora of the buzzards that chewed the flesh of the plantation dead when they were put on display. The soothing blue walls of life on the slave ship evoked the Atlantic sky. Here, Cora stalked a section of a frigate's deck, around the mast, various small barrels and coils of rope. Her African costume was a colorful wrap. Her sailor outfit made her look like a street rascal, with a tunic, trousers, and leather boots. The story of the African boy went that, after he came aboard, he helped out on deck with various small tasks, a kind of apprentice. Cora tucked her hair under the red cap. A statue of a sailor leaned against the gunwale, spyglass pointed. The eyes, mouth, and skin color were painted on its wax head in disturbing hues. Typical day on the plantation allowed her to sit at a spinning wheel and rest her feet, the seat as sure as her old block of sugar maple. Chicken stuffed with sawdust pecked at the ground. From time to time, Cora tossed imaginary seed at them. She had numerous suspicions about the accuracy of the African and ship scenes, but was an authority in this room. She shared her critique. Mr. Fields did concede that spinning wheels were not often used outdoors at the foot of a slave's cabin, but countered that while authenticity was their watchword, the dimensions of the room forced certain concessions. Would that he could fit an entire field of cotton in the display and had the budget for a dozen actors to work it. One day, perhaps. Cora's criticism did not extend to typical day's wardrobe, which was made of coarse, authentic Negro cloth. She burned with shame twice a day when she stripped and got into her costume. Mr. Fields had the budget for three actors, or types, as he referred to them. Also recruited from Miss Handler's schoolhouse, Isis and Betty were similar in age and build to Cora. They shared costumes. On their breaks, the three discussed the merits and disadvantages of their new positions. Mr. Fields let them be after a day or two of adjustments. Betty liked that he never showed his temper, as opposed to the family she had just worked for, who were generally nice, but there was always the possibility of a misunderstanding or a bad mood that was none of her doing. Isis enjoyed not having to speak. She hailed from a small farm where she was often left to her own devices, save on those nights when the master needed company, and she was forced to drink the cup of vice. Cora missed the white stores and their abundant shelves, but she still had her evening walks home and her game with the changing window displays. On the other hand, ignoring the museum visitors was a prodigious undertaking. The children banged on the glass and pointed at the types in a disrespectful fashion, startling them as they pretended to fuss with sailors' knots. The patrons sometimes yelled things at their pantomimes, comments that the girls couldn't make out, but that gave every indication of rude suggestions. The types rotated through the exhibits every hour to ease the monotony of pretending to swab the deck, carve hunting tools, and fondle the wooden yams. If Mr. Fields had one constant instruction, it was that they not sit so much, but he didn't press it. They teased Skipper John, as they nicknamed the dummy sailor, from their stools as they fiddled with the hemp rope. The exhibits opened the same day as the hospital, part of a celebration trumpeting the town's recent accomplishments. The new mayor had been elected on the progress ticket and wanted to ensure that the residents associated him with his predecessor's forward-looking initiatives, which had been implemented while he was still a property lawyer in the Griffin Building. Cora did not attend the festivities, although she saw the glorious fireworks that night from the dormitory window and got to see the hospital up close when her checkup came around. As the colored residents settled into South Carolina life, the doctors monitored their physical well-being with as much dedication as the proctors, who took measure of their emotional adjustments. Someday, Miss Lucy told Cora one afternoon while they walked the green, all the numbers and figures and notes would make a great contribution to their understanding of colored life. From the front, the hospital was a smart, sprawling, single-floor complex that seemed as long as the Griffin Building was tall. It was stark and unadorned in its construction in a way Cora had never seen before, as if to announce its efficiency in its very walls. The colored entrance was around the side, but apart from that was identical to the white entrance. In the original design, and not an afterthought, as was so often the case. The colored wing was having a busy morning when Cora gave her name to the receptionist. A group of men, some of whom she recognized from socials and afternoons on the green, filled the adjacent room while they waited for their blood treatments. She hadn't heard of blood trouble before arriving in South Carolina, but it afflicted a great number of the men in the dormitories and was the source of tremendous effort on the part of the town doctors. The specialists had their own section, it seemed, the patients disappearing down a long hall when their name was called. She saw a different physician this time, one more pleasant than Dr. Campbell. His name was Stevens. He was a northerner with black curls that verged on womanish, an effect he tempered with his carefully tended beard. Dr. Stevens seemed young for a doctor. Cora took his precociousness as a tribute to his talents. As she moved through the examination, Cora got the impression she was being conveyed on a belt, like one of Caesar's products, tended down the line with care and diligence. The physical examination was not as extensive as the first. He consulted the records from her previous visit and added his own notes on blue paper. In between, he asked her about dormitory life.
"Sounds efficient," Dr. Stevens said.
He declared the museum work an intriguing public service. After she dressed, Dr. Stevens pulled over a wooden stool. His manner remained light as he said,
You've had intimate relations. Have you considered birth control?
He smiled. South Carolina was in the midst of a large public health program, Dr. Stevens explained, to educate folks about a new surgical technique wherein the tubes inside a woman were severed to prevent the growth of a baby. The procedure was simple, permanent, and without risk. The new hospital was specially equipped, and Dr. Stevens himself had studied under the man who pioneered the technique, which had been perfected on the colored inmates of a Boston asylum. Teaching the surgery to local doctors and offering its gift to the colored population was part of the reason he was hired.
What if I don't want to? The choice is yours, of course, the doctor said. As of this week, it is mandatory for some in the state. Colored women who have already birthed more than 2 children in the name of population control. Imbeciles and the otherwise mentally unfit for obvious reasons. Habitual criminals. But that doesn't apply to you, Bessie. Those are women who already have enough burdens. This is just a chance for you to take control over your own destiny.
She wasn't his first recalcitrant patient. Dr. Stevens put the matter aside without losing his warm demeanor. Her proctor had more information about the program, he told Cora, and was available to talk about any concern. She walked down the hospital corridor briskly, hungry for air. Cora had become too accustomed to escaping unscathed from encounters with white authority. The directness of his questions and his subsequent elaborations threw her. To compare what had happened the night of the smokehouse with what passed between a man and his wife who were in love. Dr. Stevens' speech made them the same. Her stomach twisted at the idea. Then there was the matter of mandatory, which sounded as if the women, these hobwomen with different faces, had no say. Like they were property that the doctors could do with as they pleased. Mrs. Anderson suffered black moods. Did that make her unfit? Was her doctor offering her the same proposal? No. As she turned these thoughts over, she found herself in front of the Andersons' house. Her feet took over when her mind was elsewhere. Perhaps underneath, Cora was thinking about children. Maisie would be at school, but Raymond might be home. She had been too busy the last 2 weeks to make a proper goodbye. The girl who opened the door looked at Cora with suspicion, even after she explained who she was.
I thought her name was Bessie, the girl said. She was skinny and small, but she held on to the door as if more than happy to throw her weight against it to keep out intruders. You said you was Cora.
Cora cursed the doctor's distraction. She explained that her master named her Bessie, but in the quarter, everyone called her Cora because she looked so much like her mother.
Mrs. Anderson is not at home, the girl said, and the children are playing with their friends. You best come back when she's home.
She shut the door. For once, Cora took the shortcut home. Talking to Caesar would have helped, but he was at the factory. She lay in her bed until supper. From that day on, she took a route to the museum that avoided the Anderson home. 2 weeks later, Mr. Fields decided to give his types a proper tour of the museum. Isis and Betty's time behind the glass had improved their acting skills. The duo affected a plausible interest as Mr. Fields held forth on the cross sections of pumpkins and the life rings of venerable white oaks, the cracked open geodes with their purple crystals like glass teeth, the tiny beetles and ants the scientists had preserved with a special compound. The girls chuckled at the stuffed wolverine's frozen smile, the red-tailed hawk caught mid-dive, and the lumbering black bear that charged the window. Predators captured in the moment they went in for the kill. Cora stared at the wax faces of the white people. Mr. Field's types were the only living exhibits. The whites were made of plaster, wire, and paint. In one window, two pilgrims in thick wool breeches and doublets pointed at Plymouth Rock, while their fellow voyagers looked on from ships in the mural. Delivered to safety after the hazardous passage to a new beginning. In another window, the museum arranged a harbor scene, where white colonists dressed like Mohawk Indians hurled crates of tea over the side of the ship with exaggerated glee. People wore different kinds of chains across their lifetimes, but it wasn't hard to interpret rebellion, even when the rebels wore costumes to deny blame. The types walked before the displays like paying customers. Two determined explorers posed on a ridge and gazed at the mountains of the West, the mysterious country with its perils and discoveries before them. Who knew what lay out there? They were masters of their lives, lighting out fearlessly into their futures. In the final window, a red Indian received a piece of parchment from three white men who stood in noble postures, their hands open in gestures of negotiation. "What's that?" Isis asked.
"That's a real teepee," Mr. Field said. "We like to tell a story in each one, to illuminate the American experience. Everyone knows the truth of the historic encounter, but to see it before you."
"They sleep in there," Isis said. He explained, and with that the girls returned to their own windows. "What do you say, Skipper John?" Cora asked her fellow sailor. "Is this the truth of our historic encounter?" She had lately taken to making conversation with the dummy to add some theater for the audience. Paint had flaked from his cheek, exposing the gray wax beneath. The stuffed coyotes on their stands did not lie, Cora supposed, and the anthills and the rocks told the truth of themselves. But the white exhibits contained as many inaccuracies and contradictions as Cora's three habitats. There had been no kidnapped boys swabbing the decks and earning pats on the head from white kidnappers. The enterprising African boy, whose fine leather boots she wore, would have been chained below decks, swabbing his body in his own filth. Slave work was sometimes spinning thread, yes. Most times it was not. No slave had ever keeled over dead at a spinning wheel or been butchered for a tangle. But nobody wanted to speak on the true disposition of the world, and no one wanted to hear it. Certainly not the white monsters on the other side of the exhibit at that very moment, pushing their greasy snouts against the window, sneering and hooting. Truth was a changing display in a shop window, manipulated by hands when you weren't looking, alluring and ever out of reach. The whites came to this land for a fresh start and to escape the tyranny of their masters, just as the freemen had fled theirs. But the ideals they held up for themselves, they denied others. Cora had heard Michael recite the Declaration of Independence back on the Randall plantation many times, his voice drifting through the village like an angry phantom. She didn't understand the words, most of them at any rate, but "created equal" was not lost on her. The white men who wrote it didn't understand it either. If all men did not truly mean all men, not if they snatched away what belonged to other people, whether it was something you could hold in your hand, like dirt, or something you could not, like freedom. The land she tilled and worked had been Indian land. She knew the white men bragged about the efficiency of the massacres, where they killed women and babies and strangled their futures in the crib. Stolen bodies working stolen land. It was an engine that did not stop, its hungry boiler fed with blood. With the surgeries that Dr. Stevens described, Cora thought, the whites had begun stealing futures in earnest.
cut you open and rip them out, dripping. Because that's what you do when you take away someone's babies. Steal their future. Torture them as much as you can when they are on this earth, then take away the hope that one day their people will have it better. Ain't that right, Skipper John? Cora asked. Sometimes, if Cora turned her head fast, it looked as if the thing were winking at her. A few nights later, she noticed the lights in number 40 were out, even though it was early in the evening. She asked the other girls. They were moved to the hospital, one said, so they can get better. The night before Ridgway put an end to South Carolina, Cora lingered on the roof of the Griffin building, trying to see where she had come from. There was an hour until her meeting with Caesar and Sam, and she didn't relish the idea of fretting on her bed, listening to the chirping of the other girls. Last Saturday after school, one of the men who worked in the Griffin, a former tobacco hand named Martin, told her that the door to the roof was unlocked. Access was easy. If Cora worried about one of the white people who worked on the 12th floor questioning her when she got off the elevator, Martin told her, she could take the stairs for the final flights. This was her second twilight visit. The height made her giddy. She wanted to jump up and snatch the gray clouds roiling overhead. Miss Handler had taught the class about the great pyramids in Egypt and the marvels the slaves made with their hands and sweat. Were the pyramids as tall as this building? Did the pharaohs sit on top and take the measure of their kingdoms to see how diminished the world became when you gained the proper distance? On Main Street below, workmen erected 3- and 4-story buildings, taller than the old line of 2-floor establishments. Cora walked by the construction every day. Nothing as big as the Griffin yet, but one day the building would have brothers and sisters striding over the land. Whenever she let her dreams take her down hopeful avenues, this notion stirred her, that of the town coming into its own. To the east side of the Griffin were the white people's houses and their new projects, the expanded town square, the hospital, and the museum. Cora crossed to the west where the colored dormitories lay. From this height, the red boxes crept up on the uncleared woods in impressive rows. Is that where she would live one day? A small cottage on a street they hadn't laid yet? Putting the boy and the girl to sleep upstairs? Cora tried to see the face of the man, conjure the names of the children. Her imagination failed her. She squinted south toward Randall. What did she expect to see? The night took the south into darkness. And north? Perhaps she would visit one day. The breeze made her shiver, and she headed for the street. It was safe to go to Sam's now. Caesar didn't know why the station agent wanted to see them. Sam had signaled as he passed the saloon and told him, tonight. Cora had not returned to the railroad station since her arrival, but the day of her deliverance was so vivid she had no trouble finding the road. The animal noises in the dark forest, the branches snapping and singing, reminded her of their flight, and then of Lovey disappearing into the night. She walked faster when the light from Sam's windows fluttered through the branches. Sam embraced her with his usual enthusiasm, his shirt damp and reeking with spirits. She had been too distracted to notice the house's disarray on her previous visit, the grimed plates, sawdust, and piles of clothes. To get to the kitchen, she had to step over an upturned toolbox, its contents jumbled on the floor, nails fanned like pickup sticks. Before she left, she would recommend he contact the placement office for a girl. Caesar had already arrived and sipped a bottle of ale at the kitchen table.
He'd brought one of his bowls for Sam and ran his fingers over its bottom as if testing an imperceptible fissure. Cora had almost forgotten he liked to work with wood. She had not seen much of him lately. He had bought more fancy clothes from the colored emporium, she noted with pleasure, a dark suit that fit him well. Someone had taught him how to tie a tie, or perhaps that was the token of his time in Virginia, when he had believed the old white woman would free him and he had worked on his appearance. "Is there a train coming in?" Cora asked.
"In a few days," Sam said.
Caesar and Cora shifted in their seats.
"I know you don't want to take it," Sam said. "It's no matter."
"We decided to stay," Caesar said.
"We wanted to make sure before we told you," Cora added. Sam huffed and leaned back in the creaky chair.
"It made me happy to see you skipping the trains and making a go of things here," the station agent said. "But you may reconsider after my story."
Sam offered them some sweetmeats. He was a faithful customer of Ideal Bakery off Main Street and revealed his purpose.
"I want to warn you away from Reds," Sam said.
"You scared of the competition?" Caesar joked.
There was no question on that front. Sam's saloon did not serve colored patrons. No, Reds had exclusive claim to the residents of the dormitories with a hankering for drink and dance. It didn't hurt that they took scrip.
"More sinister," Sam said. "I'm not sure what to make of it, to be honest."
It was a strange story. Caleb, the owner of the Drift, possessed a notoriously sour disposition. Sam had a reputation as the barkeep who enjoyed conversation.
"You get to know the real life of a place working there," Sam liked to say.
One of Sam's regulars was a doctor by the name of Bertram, a recent hospital hire. He didn't mix socially with the other Northerners, preferring the atmosphere and salty company at the Drift. He had a thirst for whiskey.
"To drown out his sins," Sam said.
On a typical night, Bertram kept his thoughts close until his third drink, when the whiskey unstoppered him and he rambled animatedly about Massachusetts blizzards, medical school hazing rituals, or the relative intelligence of Virginia opossum. His discourse the previous evening had turned to female companionship, Sam said. The doctor was a frequent visitor at Miss Trumbull's establishment, preferring it to the Lanchester House, whose girls had a saturnine disposition in his opinion, as if imported from Maine or other gloom-loving provinces. "Sam?" Cora said.
"I'm sorry, Cora,"
he abridged. Dr. Bertram enumerated some of the virtues of Miss Trumbull's and then added,
"Whatever you do, man, keep out of Red's Cafe, if you have a taste for nigger gals."
Several of his male patients frequented the saloon, carrying on with the female patrons. His patients believed they were being treated for blood ailments. The tonics the hospital administered, however, were merely sugar water. In fact, the niggers were participants in a study of the latent and tertiary stages of syphilis.
"They think you're helping them?"
Sam asked the doctor. He kept his voice neutral, even as his face got hot.
"It's important research," Bertram informed him. "Discover how a disease spreads, the trajectory of infection, and we approach a cure."
Red's was the only colored saloon in the town proper. The proprietor got a break on the rent for a watchful eye. The syphilis program was one of many studies and experiments underway at the colored wing of the hospital. Did Sam know that the Igbo tribe of the African continent is predisposed to nervous disorders, suicide, and black moods? The doctor recounted the story of 40 slaves shackled together on a ship who jumped overboard en masse rather than live in bondage. The kind of mind that could conceive of and execute such a fantastic course
What if we performed adjustments to the nigger's breeding patterns and removed those of melancholic tendency, managed other attitudes such as sexual aggression and violent natures? We could protect our women and daughters from their jungle urges, which Dr. Bertram understood to be a particular fear of Southern white men. The doctor leaned in. Had Sam read the newspaper today? Sam shook his head and topped off the man's drink. Still, the barkeep must have seen the editorials over the years, the doctor insisted, expressing anxiety over this very topic. America has imported and bred so many Africans that in many states the whites are outnumbered. For that reason alone, emancipation is impossible. With strategic sterilization, first the women, but both sexes in time, we could free them from bondage without fear that they'd butcher us in our sleep. The architects of the Jamaica uprisings had been of Beninese and Congolese extraction, willful and cunning. What if we tempered those bloodlines carefully over time? The data collected on the colored pilgrims and their descendants over years and decades, the doctor said, will prove one of the boldest scientific enterprises in history. Controlled sterilization, research into communicable diseases, the perfection of new surgical techniques on the socially unfit. Was it any wonder the best medical talents in the country were flocking to South Carolina? A group of rowdies stumbled in and crowded Bertram to the end of the bar. Sam was occupied. The doctor drank quietly for a time and then slipped out.
You two are not the sort that goes to Reds, Sam said, but I wanted you to know.
Reds, Cora said. This is more than the saloon, Sam. We have to tell them they're being lied to. They're sick. Caesar was in agreement.
Will they believe you over their white doctors? Sam asked. With what proof? There is no authority to turn to for redress. The town is paying for it all. And then there are all the other towns where colored pilgrims have been installed in the same system. This is not the only place with a new hospital.
They worked it out over the kitchen table. Was it possible that not only the doctors but everyone who ministered to the colored population was involved in this incredible scheme? Steering the colored pilgrims down this or that path, buying them from estates and the block in order to conduct this experiment? All those white hands working in concert, committing their facts and figures down on blue paper. After Cora's discussion with Dr. Stevens, Miss Lucy had stopped her one morning on her way to the museum. Had Cora given any thought to the hospital's birth control program? Perhaps Cora could talk to some of the other girls about it in words they could understand. It would be very appreciated, the white woman said. There were all sorts of new positions opening up in town, opportunities for people who had proven their worth. Cora thought back to the night she and Caesar decided to stay. The screaming woman who wandered into the green when the social came to an end. They're taking away my babies. The woman wasn't lamenting an old plantation injustice, but a crime perpetrated here in South Carolina. The doctors were stealing her babies from her, not her former masters.
They wanted to know what part of Africa my parents hailed from, Caesar said. How was I to know? He said I had the nose of a Beninese. Nothing like flattery before they geld a fellow, Sam said. I have to tell Meg, Caesar said. Some of her friends spend evenings at Red's. I know they have a few men they see there.
Who's Meg? Cora said.
She's a friend I've been spending time with. I saw you walk down Main Street the other day, Sam said. She's very striking. It was a nice afternoon, Caesar said.
He took a sip of his beer, focusing on the black bottle and avoiding Cora's eyes. They made little progress on a course of action, struggling with the problem of whom to turn to
and the possible reaction from the other colored residents.
Perhaps they would prefer not to know, Caesar said. What were these rumors compared to what they had been freed from? What sort of calculation would their neighbors make, weighing all the promises of their new circumstances against the allegations and the truth of their own pasts? According to the law, most of them were still property, their names on pieces of paper in cabinets kept by the United States government. For the moment, warning people was all they could do.
Cora and Caesar were almost to town when he said,
Meg works for one of those Washington Street families. One of those big houses, you see?
Cora said,
I'm glad you have friends.
You sure?
Were we wrong to stay? Cora asked.
Maybe this is where we were supposed to get off, Caesar said. Maybe not. What would Lovey say?
Cora had no answer. They didn't speak again. She slept poorly. In the 80 bunks, the women snored and shifted under their sheets. They had gone to bed believing themselves free from white people's control and commands about what they should do and be, that they managed their own affairs. But the women were still being herded and domesticated. Not pure merchandise as formerly, but livestock, bred, neutered, penned in dormitories that were like coops or hutches. In the morning, Cora went to her assigned work with the rest of the girls. As she and the other types were about to get dressed, Isis asked if she could switch rooms with Cora. She was feeling poorly and wanted to rest at the spinning wheel.
If I could just get off my feet for a bit.
After 6 weeks at the museum, Cora hit upon a rotation that suited her personality. If she started in typical day on the plantation, she could get her 2 plantation shifts finished just after the midday meal. Cora hated the ludicrous slave display and preferred to get it over as soon as possible. The progression from plantation to slave ship to darkest Africa generated a soothing logic. It was like going back in time, an unwinding of America. Ending her day in scenes from darkest Africa never failed to cast her into a river of calm. The simple theater becoming more than theater, a genuine refuge. But Cora agreed to Isis's request. She would end the day a slave. In the fields, she was ever under the merciless eye of the overseer or boss.
Bend your backs! Work that row!
At the Andersons, when Maisie was at school or with her playmates and little Raymond was asleep, Cora worked unmolested and unwatched. It was a small treasure in the middle of the day. Her recent installation in the exhibition returned her to the furrows of Georgia. The dumb, open-jawed stares of the patrons stealing her back to a state of display. One day she decided to retaliate against a red-haired white woman who scowled at the sight of Cora's duties at sea. Perhaps the woman had wed a seaman of incorrigible appetites and hated the reminder. Cora didn't know the source of her animus or care. The woman irked her. Cora stared into her eyes, unwavering and fierce, until the woman broke, fairly running from the glass toward the agricultural section. From then on, Cora selected one patron per hour to evil eye. A young clerk ducking out from his desk in the Griffin, a man of enterprise, a harried matron corralling an unruly clutch of children, one of the sour youths who liked to batter the glass and startle the types. Sometimes this one, sometimes that one. She picked the weak links out from the crowd, the ones who broke under her gaze. The weak link, she liked the ring of it. To seek the imperfection in the chain that keeps you in bondage. Taken individually, the link was not much, but in concert with its fellows, a mighty iron that subjugated millions despite its weakness. The people she chose, young and old, from the rich part of town or the more modest streets, did not individually persecute Cora. As a community, they were shackles. If she kept at it, chipping away at weak links wherever she found them, it might add up to something. She got good at her evil eye, looking up from the slave wheel or the hut's glass fire to pin a person in place like one of the beetles or mites in the insect exhibits. They always broke. The people, not expecting this weird attack, staggering back or looking at the floor or forcing their companions to pull them away. It was a fine lesson, Cora thought, to learn that the slave, the African in your midst, is looking at you too. The day Isis felt under the weather, during Cora's second rotation on the ship, she looked past the glass and saw pigtailed Maisie, wearing one of the dresses Cora used to wash and hang on the line. It was a school trip. Cora recognized the boys and girls who accompanied her, even if the children did not remember her as the Andersons' old girl. Maisie didn't place her at first. Then Cora fixed her with the evil eye, and the girl knew. The teacher elaborated on the meaning of the display. The other children pointed and jeered at Skipper John's garish smile, and Maisie's face twitched in fear. From the outside, no one could tell what passed between them, just like when she and Blake faced each other the day of the doghouse. Cora thought, "I'll break you too, Maisie." And she did. The little girl scampering out of the frame. She didn't know why she did it, and was abashed until she took off her costume and returned to the dormitory. She called upon Miss Lucy that evening. Cora had been figuring on Sam's news all day, holding it up to the light like a hideous bauble, tilting it so. The proctor had aided Cora many times. Now her suggestions and advice resembled maneuvers, the way a farmer tricks a donkey into moving in line with his intentions. The white woman was gathering a stack of her blue papers when Cora poked her head into the office. Was her name written down there? And what were the notes beside it? No, she corrected. Bessie's name, not hers. "I only have a moment," the proctor said. "I saw people moving back into number 40, Cora said, "but no one who used to live there. Are they still in the hospital for their treatment?" Miss Lucy looked at her papers and stiffened. "They were moved to another town," she said. "We need room for all the new arrivals, so women like Gertrude, the ones who need help, are being sent to where they can get more suitable attention." "They're not coming back?" "They are not." Miss Lucy appraised her visitor. "It troubles you, I know. You're a smart girl, Bessie. I still hope you'll take on the mantle of leadership with the other girls, even if you don't think the operation is what you need right now. You could be a true credit to your race if you put your mind to it." "I can decide for myself," Cora said. "Why can't they?" "On the plantation, Master decided everything for us. I thought we were done with that here." Miss Lucy recoiled from the comparison. "If you can't see the difference between good, upstanding people and the mentally disturbed with criminals and imbeciles, you're not the person I thought you were." "I'm not the person you thought I was." One of the proctors interrupted them. An older woman named Roberta, who often coordinated with the placement office. She had placed Cora with the Andersons those months ago.
"Lucy, they're waiting on you."
Miss Lucy grumbled.
"I have them all right here,"
Miss Lucy told her colleague, "but the records in the Griffin are the same. The fugitive slave law says we have to hand over runaways and not impede their capture. Not drop everything we're doing just because some slave catcher thinks he's on to his bounty. We don't harbor murderers.
She rose, holding the stack of papers to her chest.
Bessie, we'll take this up tomorrow. Please think about our discussion.
Cora retreated to the bunkhouse stairs. She sat on the third step. They could be looking for anyone. The dormitories were full of runaways who'd taken refuge here. In the wake of a recent escape from their chains or after years of making a life for themselves elsewhere, they could be looking for anyone. They hunted murderers. Cora went to Caesar's dormitory first. She knew his schedule, but in her fright could not remember his shifts. Outside, she didn't see any white men, the rough sort she imagined slave catchers to look like. She sprinted across the green. The older man at the dormitory leered at her. There was always a licentious implication when a girl visited the men's housing and informed her that Caesar was still at the factory.
"You won't wait with me?" he asked.
It was getting dark. She debated whether or not to risk Main Street. The town records had her name as Bessie. The sketches on the flyers Terrence had printed after their escape were crudely drawn, but resembled them enough that any savvy hunter would look at her twice. There was no way she would rest until she conferred with Caesar and Sam. She took Elm Street, parallel to Main, until she reached the Drifts block. Each time she turned a corner, she expected a posse on horses, with torches and muskets and mean smiles. The Drift was full with early evening carousers, men she recognized and those she did not. She had to pass by the saloon's window twice before the station agent saw her and motioned for her to come around back. The men in the saloon laughed. She slipped through the light cast in the alley from inside. The outhouse door was ajar, empty. Sam stood in the shadows, his foot on a crate as he laced his boots.
"I was trying to figure out how to get word," he said. "The slave catcher's name is Ridgway. He's talking to the constable now about you and Caesar. I've been serving two of his men whiskey."
He handed her a flyer. It was one of the bulletins Fletcher had described in his cottage, with one change. Now that she knew her letters, the word murder hooked her heart. There was a ruckus from inside the bar, and Cora stepped farther into the shadows. Sam couldn't leave for another hour, he said. He'd gather as much information as he could and try to intercept Caesar at the factory. It was best if Cora went ahead to his house and waited. She ran as she had not in a long time, sticking to the side of the road and darting into the woods at the sound of a traveler. She entered Sam's cottage through the back door and lit a candle in the kitchen. After pacing, unable to sit, Cora did the only thing that calmed her. She had cleaned all the dishware when Sam returned home.
"It's bad," the station agent said. "One of the bounty hunters came in right after we spoke, had a ring of ears around his neck like a Red Indian, a real tough character. He told the others that they knew where you were. They left to meet their man in front, Ridgway."
He panted from the run over.
"I don't know how, but they know who you are."
Cora had grabbed Caesar's bowl. She turned it over in her hands.
"They got a posse together," Sam said. "I couldn't get to Caesar. He knows to come here or the saloon. We had a plan. He may already be on his way."
Sam intended to return to the Drift to wait for him.
"Do you think anyone saw us talking?"
"Maybe you should go down to the platform."
They dragged the kitchen table and the thick gray rug. Together they lifted the door in the floor. It was a tight fit, and the musty air flickered the candles. She took some food and a lantern and descended into the darkness. The door closed above her and the table rumbled back into place. She had avoided the services at the colored churches in town. Randall forbade religion on his plantation to eliminate the distraction of deliverance, and churching never interested her once she came to South Carolina. It made her seem strange to the other colored residents she knew, but seeming strange had not bothered her for a long time. Was she supposed to pray now? She sat at the table in the thin lamplight. It was too dark on the platform to make out where the tunnel began. How long would it take them to root out Caesar? How fast could he run? She was aware of the bargains people made in desperate situations, to reduce the fever in a sick baby, to halt the brutalities of an overseer, to deliver one from a host of slave hells. From what she saw, the bargains never bore fruit. Sometimes the fever subsided, but the plantation was always still there. Cora did not pray. She fell asleep, waiting. Later, Cora crawled back up the steps, perching just beneath the door, and listened. It might be day or night in the world. She was hungry and thirsty. She ate some of the bread and sausage, moving up and down the steps, putting her ear to the door and then retreating after a time. She passed the hours. When she finished the food, her despair was complete. She listened by the door. There was not a sound. The thundering above woke her, terminating the void. It was not one person or two, but many men. They ransacked the house and shouted, knocking over cabinets and upending furniture. The noise was loud and violent and so near. She shrank down the steps. She could not make out their words. Then they were done. The seams in the door permitted no light and no draft. She could not smell the smoke, but she heard the glass shatter and the pop and crackle of the wood. The house was on fire. Stevens. The anatomy house of the Proctor Medical School was three blocks away from the main building, second from last on the dead-end street. The school wasn't as discriminating as the better-known medical colleges in Boston. The press of acceptances necessitated an expansion. Aloysius Stevens worked nights to satisfy the terms of his fellowship. In exchange for tuition relief and a place to work, the late-night shift was quiet and conducive to study, the school got someone to admit the body snatcher. Carpenter usually delivered just before dawn, before the neighborhood roused, but tonight he called at midnight. Stevens blew out the lamp in the dissection room and ran up the stairs. He almost forgot his muffler, then remembered how cold it had been last time, when autumn crept in to remind them of the bitter season to come. It rained that morning, and he hoped it wouldn't be too muddy. He had one pair of brogues, and the soles were in a miserable state. Carpenter and his man Cobb waited in the driver's seat. Stevens settled in the cart with the tools. He slid down until they got a healthy distance away, in case any of the faculty or students were about. It was late, but a bone expert from Chicago had presented that night, and they might still be carousing in the local saloons. Stevens was disappointed about missing the man's talk. His fellowship often prevented his attendance at guest lectures, but the money would remove some of the sting. Most of the other students came from well-off Massachusetts families, spared worries over rent or food. When the cart passed McGinty's and he heard the laughter inside, Stevens pulled his hat down. Cobb leaned around.
"Conquered tonight," he said, and offered his flask.
As a matter of policy, Stevens declined when Cobb shared his liquor. Though still in his studies, he was certain of various diagnoses he'd made about the state of the man's health. But the wind was brisk and mean, and they had hours in the dark and mud before the return to the anatomy house. Stevens took a long pull and choked on fire.
"What is this?" "One of my cousin's concoctions. Too strong for your taste?"
He and Carpenter chortled. More likely he had collected last night's dregs at the saloon. Stevens took the prank in good cheer. Cobb had warmed to Stevens over the months.
He could imagine the man's complaints when Carpenter suggested that he stand in whenever one of their gang was too besotted or incarcerated or otherwise unavailable for their nocturnal missions. Who's to say this fancy rich boy could keep his tongue? Stevens was not rich, and was fancy only in his aspirations. The city had started hanging grave robbers lately, which was ironic or fitting, depending on one's perspective, as the bodies of the hanged were given to medical schools for dissection.
"Don't mind the gallows," Cobb had told Stevens. "It's quick enough. The people are the thing. It should be a private viewing, if you ask me. Watching a man shit his guts, it's indecent."
Digging up graves had fastened the bonds of friendship. Now, when Cobb called him doctor, it was with respect and not derision.
"You're not like that other sort,"
Cobb told him one night when they carried a cadaver through the back door.
"You're a wee shady."
That he was. It helped to be a wee disreputable when you were a young surgeon, especially when it came to materials for post-mortem dissection. There had been a body shortage ever since the study of anatomy came into its own. The law, the jail, and the judge provided only so many dead murderers and prostitutes. Yes, persons afflicted with rare diseases and curious deformities sold their bodies for study after their demise, and some doctors donated their cadavers in the spirit of scientific inquiry, but their numbers scarcely met the demand. The body game was fierce, for buyers and sellers alike. Rich medical schools outbid the less fortunate ones. Body snatchers charged for the body, then